From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, I'm Tory Maguire.
3 years ago, I committed to the British people that I would renegotiate our position in the European Union and hold an in-out referendum. And I will go to Parliament and propose that the British people decide our future in Europe.
Back in June 2016, when former British Prime Minister David Cameron buckled under significant pressure and promised a referendum on the UK's European Union membership, who could have known it was the beginning of such unmitigated chaos?
I hereby give notice that I have certified the following. The UK has voted to leave the European Union.
The Brexit vote shocked observers. 51.9% of voters were in favour of leaving the EU. Embarrassed by an unexpected defeat, David Cameron was forced to resign.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction.
Enter the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, to pick up the pieces.
Because the reality is that we all need to face up to some hard facts. Life is going to be different.
May at least had a strategy. Her plan? Go to an election, gain the mandate, strive forward with the authority of the people. But that didn't exactly pan out.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
Her deal failed in spectacular fashion. It was historic, leaving the government's Brexit plans adrift.
First, we need to confirm whether this government still enjoys the confidence of the House.
May narrowly survived a motion of no confidence on Wednesday.
The ayes to the right, 306. The noes to the left, 325. So the noes have it. The noes have it.
Her plan and the country's future hangs in the balance. Welcome to Season 2 of Please Explain, a weekly podcast from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. I'm Tory Maguire. Joining us today is James Chessel, Executive Editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and a former London correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. And we also have on the line from London Nick Miller, our UK correspondent. Welcome both.
Hi Tory.
Hi there.
Later on, we'll also be chatting with business, media and technology writer John McDooling, who's been covering what looks to be the most expensive divorce in history. And no, in that case, we're not talking about Brexit. The day after the failed Brexit vote in the House of Commons, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn brought a motion of no confidence in the government. This is what he had to say on Wednesday after the deal got rejected in spectacular fashion.
Well, the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The result of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. After 2 years of failed negotiations, the House of Commons has delivered its verdict on her Brexit deal, and that verdict is absolutely decisive. She cannot seriously believe that after 2 years of failure, she is capable of negotiating a good deal for the people of this country.
Now, it's Wednesday night in London with you, Nick. What is the state of the kingdom?
Well, it staggers on for now, mainly thanks to the Queen, who seems the only part of the Constitution that's still working. But today, as we're recording, we've just a few hours ago had this vote of no confidence, which Jeremy Corbyn brought in the May government, and it failed more or less on party lines. The May government is a minority government, but they gave a bunch of money to the Northern Irish DUP, and in return they've guaranteed supply. So it failed, and it was a bit of a way for Theresa May to rally the troops after that horrific defeat the day before, because it gave her an excuse and all of her people an excuse to stand up and say, rah, 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 go the Conservatives, where how awful is Jeremy Corbyn? He's a terrible Marxist socialist, you know, terrorist sympathiser, blah, blah, blah. So it was a funny old day after such an extraordinary historic defeat, and suddenly all the Conservatives were cheering each other. So, yeah, odd times in politics over here.
Did it work?
Well, yeah, they all looked a bit happier. I mean, it was such a miserable day the day before. I mean, it had been plain for a while, but here was the final proof that May's Brexit plans are in complete disarray. Her own party are in outright unembarrassed rebellion. And they were desperate for some sort of fillip to, you know, persuade themselves that they actually had a reason still to be in power. And it turned out from the tone of the debate today, their main reason to be in power is to stop Jeremy Corbyn being in power.
That doesn't help them get the Brexit deal any closer, though, does it?
No. It was kind of a day off, really. Nothing really progressed on Brexit at all, and they still face all of the enormous and kind of intractable problems that caused the problem in the first place, which is, you know, they go all the way back to the Brexit campaign and even before, in that the Brexiters have always been promising something that is so far has proved undeliverable.
James, Theresa May lives to fight another day, but next time anyone's having a bad day at the office, they should think about the situation that she's in now, because what are her options? She can delay Brexit, which would just be an incredible mess.
Well, that's even not strictly true. She could try to delay Brexit. So the clock is ticking on this March 29 deadline. I think we're 70-odd days away at the time of recording, which is not far, but she can't extend that date unless the EU agrees, and the EU has shown a unwillingness to agree to anything that they find unpalatable, and at the moment most of what's coming out of the UK is unpalatable to the UK. So she, after the no confidence vote was defeated, said that she would like to talk to all sides of politics to come up with what is effectively a plan B. But what that plan B is, I mean, who knows? It's really, really complicated. And Nick used the word intractable before. It's true. There are a few areas, Northern Ireland, the customs union, where it's hard to see any common ground between the various sides of politics or the various sides of this debate in the UK. So to go back to your original question, when I talk to people in UK, strangely, there's a grudging respect in some ways for the way Theresa May has handled herself. She's stuck at it. She didn't walk away like David Cameron did. She's handled herself, you know, reasonably well, which is not to say the tactics or the strategy have been great, because they haven't. And she's made it very clear she's going to stick around for as long as she's wanted. And no one in their right mind, I believe, in conservative politics in Britain would want that job at the moment. You're on a hiding to nothing, obviously. So she's got a really difficult job in front of her.
Yep. So, Nick, who are her main obstacles? I mean, obviously the opposition, the Labour opposition, is a big problem, but she's got a lot of obstacles within her own party. What do they want?
It's more what they don't want. They don't want the backstop. And I don't want to get too technical here, because you can drive yourself mad getting into the technicalities.
Oh, no, tell us what the backstop is, please.
Well, yeah, but in short, it's an insurance policy for Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace to the island of Ireland, and a big part of that peace is not having a hard border, not having, you know, guard posts and customs posts that would be a focus for sectarian anger, all that kind of stuff. So you've got to keep the border open. And so there's this insurance policy in the Brexit withdrawal agreement that says, you know, if after the transition period, which is a year or so where nothing really changes, after that, if we still don't have a new trade and customs deal that will keep this border open, then there's going to be a complicated arrangement which will essentially keep Northern Ireland and most of the UK in a customs union with the EU. And the Brexiters are saying, hang on, where's our sovereignty? Where's our independence? Where are these new trade deals? If we're still in a customs union thanks to this backstop, we haven't gained anything that we fought Brexit for. And I mean, it's a good point. It's a very good point.
So what's their proposed solution to that? A hard border?
Well, what when they do answer that question, which is only sometimes, but when they do answer it, they say that there are technological solutions, that in this age you can, you know, scan things remotely, you can check things at the factory, you can scan license plates and have, you know, computerized inventories and all of this kind of stuff, and that you don't need infrastructure at the border. But and they seem to think that no one's tested this. But the EU and the Mays negotiators have looked at this, and they've concluded that, you know, maybe in the future at some point they will be able to bring something in like this, but not yet and not in time.
Sorry to interrupt, Nick, but even then, and correct me if I'm wrong, the position of the Northern Ireland is they do not want to be treated differently. So you would have to have some checks, whether it's, you know, when goods are making their way over the ocean or whatever. It's really hard to get around that issue of having Northern Ireland being treated at the same as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. It's astonishingly difficult because essentially you're leaving the EU, you're becoming a third country, and yet you don't want to have any of the things at the border that all countries have at the border with a third country. Yeah. It's a stunningly difficult problem. The other thing that Brexiters don't like is they don't like the $39 billion, which is part of this withdrawal period that Britain's going to pay, but UK is going to pay to the EU to kind of settle its debts. And they don't see it as settling debts. They just see it as giving away money, and they hate that.
And I think, the other thing that we should try and explain, Nick did a good job with the backstop, is a no-deal Brexit, which is another potential scenario. If you get, in theory, to March 29, there's no agreement, you go into this sort of no-deal situation, which would probably result in chaos. Now, Brexit doesn't mean permanent chaos. In theory, the UK would negotiate a trade deal with the EU using the WTO and the normal mechanisms, but that takes a while. And so in the meantime, you have, you know, border checks, you could potentially have planes grounded, you know, less important but equally frustrating measures like, you know, driver's license issues for people driving in the UK, phone bills when you go into the UK, into the Europe from the UK, all sorts of stuff that would cause a huge amount of uncertainty and disruption. And everyone says they don't want, Nick, everyone says they would prefer not to go down the no-deal path. Do you think it's likely, or do you hold them at their word?
Well, my favourite quote on Brexit, which was someone who I interviewed told me this one, he said that from here on everything's unlikely, and one of the unlikely things is going to happen. Yes, no deal is unlikely. No one wants no deal. But the problem is that you have to do something positive to stop it. Otherwise, because no deal is going to happen unless there's a deal. Brexit is going to happen by force of treaty on March 29 unless someone does something to stop it. And that thing is either an extension or a delay or a deal. So no deal is a real possibility, and increasingly a growing probability with every day that passes without something else happening. And the problem with no deal, and you're right, there are all sorts of kind of issues of, you know, driver's licenses and phone roaming and all that kind of stuff. It's also going to be a massive hit to the UK economy because it's, you know, the just-in-time, the kind of roll-on, roll-off economy. And the EU and rest of the EU and the UK make things together. You know, manufacturers pass things across the channel multiple times before, you know, a plane or a car or whatever is put together. If that grinds to a halt because suddenly you don't have a customs relationship, then where the forecasts are anything up to like a 10% hit to GDP, the £100 billion a year cost to the country, you know, industries going out of business, all of that kind of stuff.
And it's not good for the EU either, is it? I mean, German manufacturers sell an awful lot of stuff in the UK, where we used to live in London, and the BMW dealership around the corner was the most successful in all of Europe. and for the reasons Nick just explained, that would be really problematic for a lot of industries in Europe, as much as it would be for the British industries.
So what are the Europeans saying this week about the vote and the mess?
It would be fair to say they're a little exasperated. They are just, well, they're each according to their national temperament, I guess. Some are more excited and some are more phlegmatic. But basically, they're just saying, okay, what do you got then? They're saying, we spent 2 years negotiating a deal. This is the deal you negotiated. How about we have that deal? And if not, well, it's going to be terrible for both of us.
Is it possible to just call the whole thing off?
Oh, it is entirely possible. In fact, there was a court case just recently that found that the UK can unilaterally call it off. All it needs is for the UK government to say, forget about it, except in more kind of legal terminology, and then all of Brexit's off.
So the referendum wasn't binding?
No, it's just advisory. But, you know, I mean, you could say that, but politically, if you ignore a referendum, then you're in for a bit of political trouble.
So another option would be to temporarily call it off and hold another referendum and see what happens?
Yeah, there is not a huge amount of support for a second referendum, even though it does seem to be a sensible option. And the reason for that is that, and it's a very good argument, is that, you know, a couple of years ago, the British people said, okay, you've asked us about this, here's our opinion. And then it was the job of the politicians to go and provide Brexit, which the country had asked for. And now if you go back to them and say, well, maybe not, are you sure? You know, that's not going to come across very well at all. People are going to be are already extremely unimpressed and are going to be even more unimpressed.
What is the mood, Nick? Are people worried? Are they angry? Are they in any way amused?
Oh, you know, the meme industry is profiting enormously from Brexit. All of the above. You know, people are bored, angry, fed up, frustrated. You know, it's you know, panel shows across the British comedy industry are living off Brexit. It's an all of the above situation. It's just extraordinary.
When the original vote happened, the decision to leave, there were literally, when I was dropping the kids off at school that morning, there were literally people walking around in the street with tears in their eyes. And, you know, we lived in a part of London that would have been pretty pro-Remain, so I'm not saying it's indicative of the whole country, but it's hard to overstate, I think, the emotional impact this has had on Britain.
Can I add to that? Because there was another anecdote I had heard the other day from the other point of view. In London, everyone was devastated, or a lot of people were devastated. But there was a researcher who I spoke to who was up in one of the kind of northern Leave voting areas. And he spoke to an old lady and explained to her, you know, the economic consequences. You know, this was after the vote. And the lady replied, do you know what? I don't mind, because the day after the Brexit vote, I walked out of my door and I felt free. And that's the other kind of emotion that Brexit has kind of inspired, this kind of nationalistic pride, you know, Britain on its own and proud, you know, sailing into the future kind of thing. And it's a very powerful emotion, that kind of nationalistic emotion.
So would there be any schadenfreude? Like, the people who said it was a bad idea at the time clearly thought maybe that this would happen. Is there anyone saying, I told you so?
Yeah, a whole lot of people are saying, I told you so. It's not a very helpful thing to say, but it makes some people feel better when they just, you know, rather than bash your head into a wall, at least you can go on Twitter and say, I told you so.
Yeah. I think it's important to acknowledge that there were reasonable arguments for Brexit in the first place, and not to look at the car crash we've had since the first referendum, or since the referendum, and say, you know what a completely stupid decision that was. People voted on the basis that they thought their politicians would act in a competent way. Now they've been let down. But if you were to say to Australians, look, you know, would you mind just passing control of your borders to a body in another country, and would you mind passing the, you know, the highest level of legal approval to a body in another country and a lot of regulatory functions, they'd say, of course not. So I think it's just really important not to characterise Brexiteers, or at least, you know, ordinary Brexiteers, as crazy people, because there were genuine problems with the EU. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, this sort of, when you talk to people in Australia, they're like, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn will win and it won't happen. Jeremy Corbyn's not a big fan of the EU either, for, you know, and he's from the left, and the left didn't like it. So, you know, these fundamental issues that created the problem in the first place, they're not going away, no matter how they muddle through this mess.
Nick, do you think that this is one of the sort of defining issues for the United Kingdom on who they are, on their national identity? They've had to really look at themselves and decide, are we European? Are we? They're no longer an empire. What state is the sort of national psyche in generally?
One of the biggest problems with Brexit for one of the biggest problems with Europe for the UK has always been is that they don't see Europe in the same way that most other Europeans do. And for the rest of Europe, they were enmeshed in the Second World War. They came out of it. They realised that they had to come together to stop this kind of thing happening again. And they came up with the idea of this project of an ever closer union. And that's really a concept that's been embraced and has a lot of force behind it even today. But for Britain, Europe, the EU has always been a market. It was the common market. It was a place to sell your goods. It was a thing that kind of rescued Britain from being the sick man of Europe, just this kind of trade and industrial opportunity that was good for the economy. So it's a much more kind of practical and less emotional project for the British, and that's why they found it easier to say, well, no, we've had enough of that, because of the other problems with the EU.
And the irony of that is that Britain's slightly different relationship with the European project, or, you know, not as high level of interest in the European project, is the reason it is good to have the UK in Europe. And we're all, for understandable reasons, focusing on what Brexit's doing to the UK. It's a wonderful story to observe. However, in the future, we'll be talking about what Brexit, if it happens, means for Europe. And Europe will be weaker for the departure of the UK. They were a good voice on when they were debating economic matters. They were a good kind of counter to the southern European countries. The countries like Germany and the Netherlands really enjoyed having them in there. And, you know, they added to the culture of the place and all that kind of stuff. So it will not turn out well for the EU. Europe is stronger with Britain inside it.
So just finally, from both of you, what is the best case scenario from now?
Well, it depends whether you're a Brexiter or a Leaver, isn't it? If you think that Brexit was a mistake from the beginning, and if you think that it really needs to just stop before it gets even more stupid, then the best case scenario from here is that, well, May will keep pushing her deal or something like it for a while, then it'll become obvious you need to have a second referendum, and this time the country will say, look, we asked you to do that, we got a better idea of what it means to do it, and we've decided we don't want it, and let's go back to business as usual, and a kind of a chastened EU will probably behave better in the future. That's your kind of idealistic view. If you're a Brexiter, the best case scenario, I would think, is I think it has to be May's deal. I think that as time ticks by and the risks of no deal become obvious or are reiterated, and the alternative is no Brexit at all, that they're going to have to say, look, it's not the Brexit that we dreamed of while we were sipping our G&Ts in the English sun, but it's a Brexit, and there's going to be a long and annoying transition, but at the end of it, we're going to get what we want, or at least close enough.
They'd have to go back to Parliament and have another vote.
Yeah. It just has that this deal has to pass. Otherwise, it's pretty much no deal or it's a referendum, as far as I can tell.
So that's the best case, James. What do you think the worst case scenario is?
Well, the worst case scenario, I think, is a no-deal Brexit that plunges the UK into the kind of economic mess that Nick hinted at before. Now, the economists haven't got all their predictions right about what will happen in the event of X, Y, and Z over the past year or so, but I think it's a pretty safe bet that a no-deal Brexit would do a lot of damage to the UK. And the time it would take to negotiate a trade deal with the WTO, and keep in mind, the UK until quite recently didn't have trade negotiators because Europe did it, would be immense in the context of the current situation. So that would be a really bad thing. The UK economy has been relatively strong over the course of the financial crisis and in the years after, not paralleling along, but it's done okay and employment's been fine. And if you were to put that at risk over your ability to execute a deal, that would be a tragedy.
Well, thanks both so much for joining me. Nick, I hope you get some sleep.
That's the plan.
Chloe Salto here, sports editor of The Age. Sport is more than a game in this city. It brings us together. It collides with business and politics. It can bring out the best in society, and sometimes it can bring out the worst. And just as sport is a cornerstone of Melbourne life, sports journalism is one of the cornerstones of The Age. From Australian cricket's ball tampering fiasco to all the big AFL stories, our reporting is more than just keeping score. It keeps the powers that be accountable and keeps you informed. This takes time and it takes money, which is why, in 2019, I encourage you to subscribe. Good journalism needs supporters. Just look for Subscribe on any of our websites.
When Mackenzie and Jeff Bezos announced their divorce, people obviously were sorry to see a recognised couple ending their marriage. That sorry quickly turned to worry. Mackenzie has been with Jeff since Amazon was just a pipe dream in a garage. Joining us to discuss the ins and outs of this is John McDooling, who writes about business, media and technology. So John, Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, worth $137 billion, and his wife Mackenzie have put out a statement saying that after loving exploration and trial separation, they will continue their shared life as friends. This is the world's biggest divorce. But why do we care so much about it?
Well, Tori, it's a pretty fascinating story on a number of levels, actually. I mean, you know, no one wants to make judgments about people's personal lives and things like that.
Oh, yes, we always want to do that.
But I guess from a business point of view, the news surfaced just days after Amazon became the world's most valuable company. It's got a market value of about $800 billion, or that's about $1 trillion Australian. The company has been on an incredible rise over the past few years, and Jeff Bezos has become, I guess, sort of the number one founder figure in the tech industry at a time when the likes of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have fallen from grace a bit, and some of the other big CEOs like the Apple CEO Tim Cook and Microsoft's Satya Nadella are very respected people, but they're not. They don't have that aura of founders. And that rise of Amazon has largely, or the perception of that has been that it's down to Jeff Bezos and his unique management style, his sort of ruthless approach, his high performance culture. Amazon every day is day one on Amazon. That's emblazoned all over the walls of the building of its headquarters in Seattle. This company is known for its relentless growth focus and its sort of brilliant execution at everything it does. So in that light, for him to be, for this very stereotypical divorce, for him to be involved in with his wife, all signs were that it was a very strong marriage on the outside. He was known as a family man. For him to be having this divorce with a TV presenter certainly came as a shock to outside observers.
In a business sense, why does it matter? I mean, Mackenzie was no trophy wife, was she? She was there from literally day one of Amazon, wasn't she? And she helped build the company.
That's right. She was there. I think they got together in 1993 when the company was in its... I think they met actually before Amazon when they were working together at a hedge fund in New York. But, you know, she was there for the entire, you know, this incredible run that the company has experienced. On a business question, which investors are asking about, is whether this is going to affect the company. I guess most of the big tech companies and a lot of media companies like News Corp, most of the big tech companies have what's known as a dual class share structure. I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but it's a structure that entrenches the founder control over these companies. The founders own all the voting stock and can control the board and that type of thing. Amazon actually doesn't have one of those. So in theory, if McKenzie was to get half of the Bezos stake in Amazon, Jeff Bezos owns about 16% of the company. If she got 8% of that, she could do all sorts of things. Right. If it was a messy divorce, she could try and, you know, orchestrate some kind of board coup or that type of thing. People actually don't think that could happen, but with divorces like these, you don't know. She could move to sell lots of stock, which could hurt the company's share price and things like that. So it is a bit of a wild card. I guess the statement that they released did seem very amicable and seemed like her name was on the statement, even though Jeff tweeted it out. So, it looks like an amicable divorce, but with these things, you just never know.
This is getting into the relationship stakes here, and I know you're not a relationship guru like any of us aren't, but people say money changes people. These two met, they would have already been well-off middle-class people working in a hedge fund, but he's now literally the richest man on the planet. How much of it do you think has to do, like, how is a marriage supposed to survive going from, you know, being quite normal to being in the stratosphere like that?
It's a really good question. There has been this time last year, I remember writing a column about it on how Jeff Bezos had started to change. There were sort of images of him back when Amazon was founded as this geeky computer nerd in front of a computer with a stack of books next to him. And then, you know, last year there were photos of him emerging from a helicopter with aviator sunglasses on. He'd obviously been working out and things like that. You know, it's hard to, you know, it certainly suggests that money changes things. And he's also become this, as I was saying earlier, he's become this visionary figure who is so respected by everyone in tech and in business. You know, people quote Jeff Bezos like they used to quote Warren Buffett. He's got all sorts of idioms about how to run companies and things like that. And, you know, with that amount of money and respect and power, he also personally owns the Washington Post. With that combination, you know, maybe that does change people.
Tell me about the situation with Donald Trump. Why is Donald Trump so gleeful about this divorce? He's had a few of his own.
Yes. So the other aspect to this story, which makes it so fascinating, is the sort of media political aspect to it. So a few years ago, Bezos personally acquired the Washington Post, which has been very critical of the Trump administration and broken a lot of big stories about the president. The president himself is engaged in this war on the press. He's been, you know, he's very critical of the New York Times and the Washington Post. And there has been speculation that the divorce announcement was brought forward because a tabloid, the National Enquirer, which it turns out has close links to Donald Trump, I think the owner is a friend of the president's, was about to expose the divorce. That's led to a lot of conspiracy theorizing, but in the meantime, it's just been an opportunity for the president to talk again about Jeff Bezos and the biased Washington Post. I think he's called Jeff Bezos Jeff Bozo in tweets, and he's predicted that the divorce is going to be a beauty, and it just feeds into his sort of war on the press, and you know, he wants to depict the press as an enemy. He's also been very critical of Amazon for taking jobs away from the heartland of America, and for he says exploiting the US government's postal service in the way it delivers things around the country. This is obviously an opportunity for him to,
it's just a bit of Schadenfreude, really, isn't
yeah
it?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so just finally, the whole sort of performance nature of how they're messaging this, that, you know, they tried hard, they're still friends, they're still going to work together. It's almost become like a competitive sport, hasn't it, in high-profile business divorces, that, you know, everyone portrays it as a really positive development.
Yes, that's right. Obviously, it probably goes back to this is really not an area of my strength, but it probably goes back to the Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin.
Oh, come on,
divorce.
I see you on Goop every now and again.
Yeah, it was what was the phrase they used?
Conscious uncoupling.
The Bezos divorce, they attempted to get it out in front of the story and portray it as a personal growth in their lives and that type of things. And I think, you know, at least for the first day, and until the news of the alleged affair or the relationship emerged, it seemed to work. People seemed to think that the statement was handled pretty well, and that type of thing. But you know how this world's history's biggest divorce plays out remains to be seen. We don't, you know, at the moment it looks like it's going to be amicable, but just with these things, you just
I don't know. Half of $137 billion could be, you know, quite a consoling thing for someone to walk away from a marriage with.
Yeah, and that's also true.
Even
and
if their feelings are hurt,
that's right. And they obviously had, they had kids together as well. And you know, Mackenzie, I think her career as a novelist, she, you know, it's not in her interest to kind of destroy Amazon or anything like that, because you know, that's, you know, they have kids together, and she wants them to have evidently have as much wealth as possible as well, you would imagine. Yeah.
So, John, do you think analysing relationships are going to be a little journalistic sideline for you from this point forward, or are you just going to stick to business and media and tech?
Yeah, I'll probably stick to the latter, I think.
All right. Well, thanks for this week.
Thank you.
John McDooling is a business, media and technology writer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Thanks to James Chessel, Nick Miller and John McDooling for joining us today. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Just a reminder, this week it's your last chance to get a newspaper subscription half price. If you sign up before January 24, you'll get full digital access on all your devices to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald online, plus hard copies of the weekend papers delivered to your door, all at half price, $3.95 for the first 6 months. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Rachel Dexter. Technical assistance from Declan Bowering and David McMillan. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.
The eyes to the right, 306. The nose to the left, 325. So the nose have it. The nose have it.
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased that this House has expressed its confidence in the government tonight. Take this responsibility lightly, and my government will continue its work to increase our prosperity, guarantee our security, and to strengthen our union.